Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Nearly every day, we hear the stories from victims of crime and violence. We hear about the horrific car accidents that end with passengers surviving and sometimes not. We hear about medical emergencies and efforts that save a lot of lives. What we don't hear about very often is the impact these incidents have on those whose job it is to get there first. Well, tonight we will hear from them, the first responders, and what they're going through and how they are managing. My guests are Dave Hoagland, president of the D.C. Firefighter Association, IAFF, Local Number 36, and Greg Pemberton, union chair of the D.C. Fraternal Order of Police. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us for this important conversation.
Harold, thanks for having us.
Sure thing. Before I get into my questioning, I want to ask you, Dave, whether or not you have any information about a report of a near double drowning in Northeast that happened about an hour or so ago. We were hearing reports that there were two people who were revived. This was at the Hagen Pool in Fort Lincoln in Northeast. Do you have any information about that? I know it's kind of new.
Thanks for having me, Harold. No, I have nothing up to date besides the fact of what you already reported, which they were, our units responded and they were treated and transported to the hospital. So I don't have any updates on the patient's conditions.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, certainly a lot of people are probably, concerned about that. And certainly if anything comes up between now and the end of the program, please let us know. I want to start with you, Greg. Simple question. How's the rank and file doing considering the rise in crime in the District of Columbia and just the pressures of the day-to-day? What are you hearing?
We're not in a great spot, Harold, I'll tell you that. The police department has lost about 1,200 officers in the past 3 years. We've only been able to replace about 600 of those. We're currently running at a deficit of about 600 police officers from where we were in 2020. And not to mention that, with that shortage of officers, we've had a significant increase and uptick in crime, as you mentioned in your intro. Homicides that we've hit 130, which are up 17%, sexual assaults up 33%, violent crime up 33%, all crime is up 30%, carjackings are up 100%. And that increased demand falls on the remaining officers that are here, which is more work. And the way that the department is filling that gap is through about 1 million hours of overtime that is mandatory most of it every year for officers to just be able to staff the demand of people calling 911 and reporting crimes. So we're obviously not in a great spot. Morale is not really in a great spot. These officers, they come in every day. Men and women, they want to protect these communities. They want to make sure that we're driving crime down, that we're apprehending criminals, that we're trying to keep these neighborhoods safe, particularly our most vulnerable communities. And it just it seems like a never-ending cycle that we can't get in front of right now. So it's a very tough place for the police department to be, but I can tell you that the men and women, the Metropolitan Police Department, are going to go out every day. They're going to do their job. They're going to do the best they can to try to make an impact. Time and time again, it seems like it's not enough to get the job done.
Same question, for you, Dave. And the thing that really kind of comes to mind for, firefighters, the EMTs, probably one of the more horrific incidents that we've seen recently is that Rock Creek Parkway, a head-on collision, a woman, as you know, who is accused of drunk driving. There was a rideshare driver and two passengers who were killed. I've seen, the photographs from a distance. And when you have, these firefighters, these EMTs, these paramedics, these people who get to the scene first, and the horror that they see, not just on that day, but then there's what they see the next day or what they saw the day before. How do they address that, you know, in their heads? What are you hearing, and what is the department doing to help them address those kinds of horrific on-the-job incidents?
So our members all have their own individual ways of coping, and it's all sort of part of the job. And as you get experience, you know, and you're exposed to these traumas, you learn to deal with them. But as we're learning about, as we learn more and more about PTSD, we learn that every incident affects people differently. So I might be on the exact same incident as somebody else, and it affects me in a completely different way. Or I may have seen, you know, 20 of these bloody car accidents, but it's the 21st one that I run that for some reason, you know, that trauma is triggered. But I think the biggest way we deal with it is, you know, there on the scene, we're focused on the job, right? You've got your adrenaline pumping, and you're just focusing on rescuing the people, getting them out of the car, getting them out of the fire, you know, whatever the medical, getting them out of the pool, like this evening. And, you know, it's kind of once you get back to the firehouse, you know, you talk amongst the crew. You know, that's kind of a unique position that the firefighting profession is that we're always living at the firehouse. So 24/7, somebody's at the firehouse. So after incidents, you kind of have time to discuss them with each other. One of the things that was an initiative that Local 36 started and really stepped into the area on, and then the department, you know, working with the department now, we've got a joint team, but something we called peer support. And so we train our own members to deal with these traumatic incidents and talk to people about, you know, the trauma that they saw. So we have a hotline that members can call 24/7, whether they're at work or not, and talk to one of their peers about what they've seen and faced. And where that is a benefit is the peers they're talking to have been through similar incidents, so they really understand it from that unique sphere. And especially more serious incidents, they can show up to the firehouse. People can get sent home for the night if they're just in a place where they feel like they can't go to work. But, you know, as you know, one person's emergency is sort of our day-to-day, so I think we have a higher level of conditioning to it. But it's just important for everybody to kind of live balanced, healthy lifestyles to cope with this trauma that they see.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tonight, we are talking to the first responders, asking them how they deal with the pressure and the risks and the dangers of the job. If you have a comment, if you have a question, lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You said something, Dave, that kind of struck me. You said after an incident, you go back to the firehouse and you have an opportunity to talk about this. And even though the thing that comes to my mind is, but do you have time? Because if you think, and this was actually Fairfax County, but I'm sure you heard over the 4th of July weekend, and there were, in one day, 12 fires. And so I would imagine that there are just as many emergencies, health emergencies, accidents, shootings, and the like that happen back to back to back to back to back. Do you have time to talk about it when these things are happening one after the other, Dave?
That's a good point. I've worked at firehouses over my career that are like that, where it's just you get to work in the morning and you're not off until you get off the next 7 o'clock the next morning because you're just that busy. So a lot of times, you know, it's after your shift that you have time to sit down and digest and deal with this. So you are right in that aspect that, you know, our members are oftentimes exposed to this repeated trauma and events. And, you know, that's why we always work with the city and the department, and we're working to kind of expand the resource delivery, because as the city, you know, has grown over the past 30 years, the fire department really hasn't added any new firehouses or a terrible amount of new units. So meanwhile, you know, as we're like discussing this evening, violent crime especially is at levels not seen for a number of years. So, you know, some of the solutions are to that obviously are longer term, because you can't build a firehouse overnight. And we're having a lot of the same hiring struggles that that Greg mentioned, and, you know, having issues with recruitment. And the fire department itself is in a staffing shortage as well. We're into mandatory overtime for the first time ever. So we're dealing with a lot of that, those same challenges, just the public safety space in general.
Mm-hmm. Greg, talk to me about, you know, the rank and file officers. And I don't know whether or not you were here during the, you know, the late 80s, 90s and the like. I was, and, you know, I was an older, you know, older teenager and, you know, very, very young man. But I remember when D.C. was called Dodge City, murder capital. I'm not being hyperbolic when I say that blood was literally running in the street. Murders, you know, in excess of 300 a year. How does now compare to that time, whether it's what you've seen or what you've heard about it?
It is slightly before my time. I came on the department in the early 2000s, but you know, I am familiar with the statistics and the data and the history of that period of time. And you're right, there were years that when we had exceeded 400 homicides, and it was a struggle for the department to keep up with that. And what I would say is that as we look at these crime stats that we're in right now, while they're not quite to that level, they appear to be trending in that direction in a very, very concerning way. We're right now with 130 homicides, and just getting into July means that we're on pace to well exceed 200 this year, which means this would be our third year in a row of exceeding 200 homicides. That's a number that we hadn't seen before that since 2003. And when you look at the numbers of shootings, the numbers of armed robberies and carjackings, with those, the increases in those categories in double digits as well, it's only a matter of time before we find ourselves in a similar situation, which is obviously catastrophic. The biggest concern that we have right now in trying to avoid that destiny is to make sure that we have the proper number of police officers on the department. There's been a lot of debate and a lot of rhetoric over the past few years about how many police officers we should have, or what the scope of responsibilities that they should be engaged in, or how much ability they should have to get out and do the police work that we used to have done in the past. Unfortunately, what wasn't part of that discussion is the demand that's out there, is the number of 911 calls that we respond to, the number of reports we have to file, the number of crimes we have to investigate. And as we've made efforts to reduce the size of the police department, that's been a mutually exclusive discussion from violent crime and the demand for police resources. And I think that that's an unfortunate aspect of it, because I do think that's exacerbating the problem to see these crime numbers continue to climb.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about the impact of crime and violence and the risks and the dangers of the job for first responders here in the District of Columbia. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Of course, we will be taking your calls all the way up until about 8 o'clock or so. You know, Greg, Dave talked about programs to help firefighters deal with the stresses and the mental health issues. Does the police department or the union have anything similar? Or is it the same program as the fire department has?
We do, and it's not quite the same. I think we have a pretty robust program through, you know, the union has developed its employee assistance program, and it employs a number of doctors and clinicians who are privately operated and are affiliated with the department, and our members can go see them and make appointments with them and schedule time, whether that's in person or via telephone or even through telemedicine type visits. The problem is that we've seen a huge uptick in the demand for those doctors and those appointments, and we've had a hard time filling the vacancies for the doctors that perform that service. It's a very important part of the job. We encourage all of our members to take part in it. You know, policing, and I'm sure the stats are very similar for David's men and women in the firefighting industry, but there's a lot more prevalence of PTSD, significantly higher rates of depression and anxiety. We have a much higher suicide rate than that in the general public. And, you know, productivity and efficiency is affected, as well as people's mental health and their home life. So, you know, the issue we have right now is as you've been talking about throughout the show, is the amount of trauma that these men and women experience when they go to these scenes, you know, seeing these homicides, seeing these shootings, seeing crimes against children, you know, seeing accidents, as you mentioned. These things tend to weigh on officers, and whether you're going to one a day or you're going to one a week or one a year, they can stick with you for a long time, and it's important that these officers process that information so that they can come back and be productive members of the department.
Hold on, Greg. I'm going to let you finish your point, but I've got to take a quick break. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about D.C. first responders, how they are handling the pressures of the job. Lines are still open. We'll take your calls after the break. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141, the original Quiet Storm, up next on WHUR. I'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about D.C. first responders and how they deal with the pressure, the risks, and the dangers of the job. My guests are Dave Hoagland, president of the D.C. Firefighter Association, IAFF, Local Number 36, and Greg Pemberton, Union Chair of the D.C. Fraternal Order of Police. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you're having difficulty getting through, keep trying. I promise I will get to all of your phone calls. Greg, please finish your point.
Yeah, thank you, Harold. I think that the issues that we're dealing with right now are that with this increase in violent crime, with the shortage of police officers, you have more police officers doing more work and seeing more of this trauma. And we're seeing a huge demand at our employee assistance program and other services that we provide to try to address that kind of trauma and make sure that people are processing it properly. And hopefully what we can do is either get the staffing back to a level where there's a little bit less demand on each individual officer, or expand these programs to make sure that everybody can take advantage of them. Because, you know, I think as Dave and I have both been stating, and I know you said in your intro, it's very important that these officers are addressing these things. We know that officers believe there's a stigma associated with seeking mental health treatment. I think there's a lot of people in this country that are trying to make sure that first responders get past that, and if there are issues, that they're going and they're getting the treatment that they need, so that we can make sure that these people have a healthy home life and a healthy work life and can actually have an enjoyable career.
Yeah. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lisa, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Lisa. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to add to what is being said in the program. I am a mental health practitioner, and I specialize in public safety, and I am actually employed by an area in Virginia, one of the cities in Virginia, over all of public safety, the fire, sheriff, police, and emergency call center. And I want people to hear that the industry in and of itself of public safety is trying to do more to support the employees, but we as the public really need to be a part of the solution. And I know a lot of the officers, I know a lot of the firefighters, everybody in the field is used to negative vitriol. But the other piece of it is that they are also human beings who have families, who also have stress and also are trying to manage life. And where there are some bad apples in every profession, not every profession is totally bad apples. So I just wanted to say I very much support public safety, and I encourage others to consider that it's worth doing for all of us. And if you're a mental health practitioner, you need to begin your specialization in public safety because they need a lot of us.
Lisa, thank you so much for your comment. I appreciate it. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Somebody was going to make a comment, Dave or Greg?
Harold, I was going to say Lisa's comment. So, you know, Greg mentioned the practitioners they have. And we also have the practitioners through our program we're actually working on in the hiring process right now. Working on getting a mental health practitioner that we've been able to get funding for to hire as part of the fire and EMS department budget. And you know, kind of to echo what Greg said, I think the challenge we have is finding mental health practitioners who have experience with working with first responders or, you know, military and PTSD, things like that. You know, we appreciate Lisa's words of support and experience she has with it.
Dave, I want to, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, this recent incident where, you know, firefighters were attacked while they were, you know, responding to an emergency, you know, incident where there was a lieutenant and there was another firefighter or EMT who was attacked and you know, they had to get dragged into court about this. You know, I got to tell you, maybe I'm just a little too old school. Maybe I just don't understand what is happening on the streets. But, you know, for firefighters, these are the folks that, you know, these are the folks that keep your house from burning down. The EMTs, the paramedics, these are the ones who save you from heart attacks, or, you know, these are the folks who are using the jaws of life when you have a car accident. And at least, you know, I've always just found it a little mystifying recently that people are now bothering firefighters and EMTs when they're trying to save lives. What's going on with that?
So that's a great question, Harold, and I think it really kind of speaks to a larger issue that Greg's members and my members both face, which is, you know, the city's really in the midst of a public health crisis, whether it's addiction or mental illness. And we've been trying to work really hard with city leaders to try to see if we can get some other agencies to step in and, you know, address these situations because, you know, a whole other aspect that they use police and fire for in the city is sort of the frontline mental health and addiction counselors. You know, we really have not a lot of training in that, but we run all sorts of overdoses or people who are in, you know, the medical term for it is excited delirium if they're high on something like PCP or K2, and there's all these synthetic drugs out there. So we'll be on the scene of emergency and, you know, like the gentleman who assaulted our members on North Capitol Street.
Right.
I'm sure I certainly do not judge him for what he did. You know, I'm sure he's a perfectly pleasant individual, you know, when he's sober, and I'm empathetic to the struggle that he was going through when he assaulted our members. You know, if you've ever had the occasion to encounter anybody who's sort of in this state, it's pretty wild. They have super strength. It usually takes several police officers to sort of restrain them and wrestle them down. But, you know, we've gotten to that point where MPD's having to restrain the patients, and then, you know, we're stepping in, and sometimes we're using medications to calm them down. It's really too late because, you know, they're already in a state of crisis. So I think a lot of what I'm trying to work on is figure out ways that we can identify these individuals in the city who are in crisis to avoid situations like that from happening. That was a incident that got a lot of coverage, but if not daily, but at least a few times a week, we have members who get assaulted to varying degrees of severity. And it's unfortunate that firefighters, who are also trained as EMTs and paramedics, we're there to help show up and render aid. We're not trained in de-escalation tactics or any kind of, you know, self-defense. We don't carry weapons or anything like that, so there's really no way for us to respond. So at that unfortunate occurrence, you know, our members were there helping other people. That gentleman had been there from the start, and he was sort of walking in, walking away. They'd called for MPD, and they were still on the way. And it was just kind of unfortunate timing, and one of those situations where unfortunately, you know, MPD wasn't there at the same time. And so, you know, our members kind of got put there, but as soon as the emergency call went out, they showed up right away. It was, you know, and I want to be clear that, Greg's officers always have our back, and it was not a result of any of their actions that caused that incident. It was just, you know, a combination of when the 911 call came in, how it came in, and trying to get there. But also, you know, as Greg alluded to, you know, it was also very possible that many of his officers were tied up on other incidents and unavailable to help us. So it's some things we're trying to work on. For instance, not having us dispatched at the exact same time. Unfortunately, I don't have enough hands to count the amount of times where I've been the first on scene of a shooting, just because the way it gets dispatched and the calls are processed, we're dispatched at the same time. So it's just some lessons that our members have really taken from this incident, which is just not to put yourselves out there, really, really stand back and wait till we have the protection of the police before we treat some of these individuals.
Well, I was about to say, because if you get a report of a shooting, someone's life is in danger, they are down, they are bleeding, and that your job, correct me if I'm wrong, is to save lives. And sometimes, as you just said, you've got to walk into situations which are not really stable in order to try to save the life that came down in that call.
Yeah, there's always a certain amount of risk, right? And so I just want sort of, you know, and I think the public is aware of that, just to keep in mind in that particular incident that it was just sort of, that was just the same as if a layperson was assaulted. You know, we don't really
right.
have any tools in our toolbox and try to think about how they would react if they were assaulted. So, you know, we'll see. I'm hopeful, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office will sort of reevaluate their decision. I know that individual who assaulted our member was arrested about a week later because a shop owner in the same area recognized him when he assaulted the shop owner back in April. So I think he's shown up in court as a result of that assault. So hopefully, you know, that will bring a little bit of accountability to that individual. But I can think of another example that I experienced myself. If you recall, you know, last summer, the summer before that shooting at 14th and U during that Mochella festival.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, so it kind of speaks well to what we were talking about. I had a rookie with me, a brand new firefighter, and she grew up in that area. And so we were literally on the scene of that treating somebody. And then we walked away. I was at the firehouse at 16th and U at the time, which is right by it's essentially almost attached to the MPD 3rd District Police Station. And we just see people starting to run in our direction. And then, you know, we get reports of the shooting. So we show back up there, and it was an incredibly bold crime, right? Like, the person who did the shooting was standing, I think, within feet of an officer, literally practically touching one of Greg's officers and shot the officer in the leg. And then a couple more people got shot, including a young 15-year-old. So, you know, my rookie, who she's only been on the job for a very long time, and this was probably her fourth or fifth shooting, and she grew up in the neighborhood. And so this is her fourth or fifth shooting, and she's known most of the shooting victims, right? So here's this repeat trauma, you know. So the next day, we're talking, I'm helping her. You know, we got her over to peer support, but she's, you know, sending me pictures of the kid who passed away,
mm-hmm.
you know, Instagram and everything like that, because she was in the back of the ambulance and literally, you know, watched the life leave this kid, right? So that is trauma that she needs to wear and own for the rest of her career. So, you know, we were able to get her help, but it's just, you know, we drive around this city and we have a different outlook on it, right? You know, if I'm walking around with my family and we're at a street corner, right, I know that I've never going to look at 14th and U the same, right? Or there's a million other intersections where you kind of alluded to it in the 80s and 90s where I've literally seen blood running down the street, right?
Yeah.
So our members are going to have a very different picture of things, and you just need to – everybody has their own way of processing and dealing with trauma, but like Greg said, I think we've been doing a really good job in public safety of just getting people help.
Yeah.
And getting them to talk about these so they don't, so that trauma doesn't get turned inward and cause stress in their own personal lives and home.
Greg, talk to me about where DC is in dealing with the whole tinted window thing. I know young people, old people, and everybody in between, if you've got a sporty car and you want tinted windows and you think it looks cool and the whole bit. Yeah, I never understood it because I can't see out. But you also can't see in. And I can only imagine the kind of risk that a tinted window situation may present in a regular traffic stop or dealing with some known bad guys.
Yeah, well, there's a broader issue when it comes to dealing with traffic stops in general, which is that over the course of the past few years, the city council has lumped on mountains of legislation that make it very difficult for police officers to engage in pedestrian stops and traffic stops and other what we would know as sort of bread and butter of policing, right? If a police officer has what we call reasonable suspicion, if they think they can articulate that people are up to no good, they can stop them and investigate. Doesn't mean they're under arrest, but they can detain them momentarily and ask some questions. And for police, for cars and vehicles, if you believe a car has violated the law, you can stop them and do an investigation and see who's driving that car and run criminal checks and whatnot. And these provisions that have been lumped on the city through these policing and justice acts passed by the council have just made it almost impossible for officers to engage in that kind of behavior without exposing themselves to discipline and civil action and even criminal action in the case of some of these vehicular pursuits, which is what earlier this week the council was rescinding because they had gone too far in some of that language. So traffic stops generally have dropped, and not because officers aren't interested in engaging them, but because the city council has sent messaging not only through their legislation, but through their rhetoric, that they don't want officers engaging in that sort of enforcement. You know, just as an example, for the period of time from 2008 to 2018, we were averaging about 45,000 arrests per year. Since then, we've only been averaging about 15,000 to 20,000 arrests. And a lot of that is a reduction in the number of traffic stops. So we're not pulling people over. And when we are pulling people over, we're finding out that they don't have a valid license or they're not carrying insurance or they have an extraditable warrant from somewhere, or maybe there's some kind of contraband in the car that they're not supposed to have and they're arrested for that. And once we're reducing those types of enforcement, a lot of those sort of bread and butter policing, a lot of that stuff gets lost. And so while you point out specifically the tinted window issue, which is an issue for police officers because it is unlawful to have that in the district at a certain level, and we should be enforcing that for safety issues, but I think there's just been a general reduction in the number of traffic stops that we have out there across the board, which is probably more of a problem at this point.
We had D.C. Council member Brooke Pinto on yesterday from Ward 2. And one of the things she did say yesterday after this emergency crime bill passed was that there was a clarification in the policy for police chases. What are your thoughts about the clarification and the circumstances under which police can chase a suspect? Because we all know that while in some cases it may be necessary, in almost all cases it can be a very dangerous thing.
It absolutely can be. And the District of Columbia, the Metropolitan Police Department, has a very, very restricted chase policy for that very reason. Our officers understand that. We understand that racing through these streets in the city can be dangerous to community members, to the police officer, to the suspect even. And we have to be very careful with that. But what happened is in the bill that I've repeatedly mentioned today in the interview is this 2020 Policing and Justice Reform Act. And I think what council member pointed out, which was very valid, was that the provisions on restricting police pursuits were so onerous that it actually created an environment where there was no possible scenario that an officer could lawfully chase a vehicle without exposing themselves to criminal penalties. And the police department identified that as officers were having to deal with the situation, and some mid-level managers and tenants and captains were actually coming across real-world situations, realizing that it now, because of this new law, was physically impossible for officers to do this. They went back to the council, particularly Council Member Pinto. They explained the situation. She realized that they had gone way too far in this Policing and Justice Reform Act, and they decided to go back and amend it. And particularly what they did was they changed the language so that officers could engage in these pursuits, but again, limited, very limited in the capacity that they could do so, so that we're not endangering the community. But if there is one of these situations that warrants that, the officers can pursue that to try to get that person apprehended and get them off the streets. Mm-hmm.
Dave, aside from more personnel and, you know, more equipment, what is it that can make the job of your rank and file easier or better, if not easier?
Well, you know, I want to say that, you know, the city as a whole, right, and society in general is very grateful for first responders and what they do. But, you know, I think I heard you talking about it, or Lisa, when she called in, you know, just to remember that you're dealing with a human on the other end of the line who, yes, is a highly trained human to address these moments of crisis and et cetera. But, you know, it's kind of a complicated issue, and I want to say it's a lot of it is tied in to the pandemic and post-pandemic, but I think people were shut inside at home for so long that everybody forgot to interact and didn't learn, you know, forgot how to interact face-to-face. And, you know, I think people just in general seem to have a harder time in situations like that. But, you know, I think just to make it easier, you know, stay off your cell phones when you're driving. Don't blast your music too loud so everybody can get out of the way. Be very vigilant, hyper-vigilant when you're a pedestrian and when you're a bicyclist, watching out for police and fire apparatus responding to emergencies. But also, you know, remember we're there to help, and, you know, it might be as simple as somebody might be saying, hey, you're not hurrying fast enough or something like that, and sort of maybe being critical of our responders' performance on the scene, not realizing that there's a reason that they're moving at the speed that they're moving, or they're getting equipment, and we have a very systematic approach to what we do. You know, just really to have patience, know that our responders are out there and they really care. You know, they're always, they're there to help. They care about their jobs and really consider it a privilege for what they do in the city. And yeah, just, you know, say thank you and, you know, be more appreciative of it. And then, you know, as we've kind of talked about, try to put some other support structures in place. Go see your primary care doctor. That's a lot of our more minor incidents that we end up running is just be more proactive about your own health at home. And if you don't have a primary care physician, you know, work to get access to one. There's avenues through the city and Department of Health that you can do that, especially if you're uninsured. Because, you know, our members also deal with a lot of crowded emergency rooms. Spend hours waiting at the hospitals right now because of staffing shortages inside hospitals. And try some of these new initiatives that we're doing. For instance, if you call 911, they have a nurse triage line now where they'll get you on the phone with a nurse. And, you know, while you may feel as though it's an emergency, it might not warrant a hospital visit. So maybe have some patience and give that nurse a chance rather than sort of demanding that an ambulance show up and take you to the hospital, because you're likely going to get seen faster if you go to an urgent care clinic or talk to this nurse triage line on the phone.
You know, it's interesting, something you just said that I found fascinating. When you take someone to a hospital because they've, you know, whether it's a crime of violence or whether it's a car accident or they have had a heart attack, you don't just drop them off.
Right.
You've got to kind of stay there with them. Why? Explain how that works, please.
Well, so when you get to the hospital, you can't just say, Howard University Hospital is actually doing a pilot program for this now that they've been trying to work on, which is essentially they're allowing us to offload more minor patients in the waiting room. And essentially here, we took your number. We gave an initial report about what was going on with you with the nurse so that these ambulances can go back in service. But a lot of times you have to sit and wait at the hospital for hours for there to be space for a bed because the hospital's backed up. They're trying to either discharge people from the emergency room or move them to other portions of the hospital where there's no room. And a lot of the hospitals in the city, or really all of them, don't pour a lot of financial resources into emergency rooms because they're making all their money on cardiac procedures and elective surgeries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a huge incentive for them to invest in emergency care, which, you know, the council's been working hard on, and we've been really working hard to get access to care. But, you know, you get to the hospital and you take a report, they do what's called triage you, and then it might just be, hey, you got to sit here and wait on the ambulance stretcher, or hey, we're going to take you out to the waiting room because it's not a serious emergency. Well, so then that translates out on the street, and you have a, like, you know, you were talking about back-to-back shootings, you know, and that's, unfortunately, sadly, that's any day of the week in the district, in especially in certain parts of the city. So I can think of a lot of scenes we showed up to that are sort of hostile because you get there and the people are frantic, right? Because someone's shot and bleeding on the ground, and they're like, come, help, help. Like, why didn't you get here sooner? You should have gotten here faster. And a lot of times it's because the ambulance had to come from another part of town because the ambulance that serves that neighborhood is stuck at the hospital because somebody who lived around the corner where they were shot called 911 because they've had a fever or, you know, stubbed their toe or just weren't feeling great but, you know, really wanted to go to the hospital, which obviously we're never going to deny care to anybody, but you know, the department in the last few years has done a lot to try to address some of these more minor emergencies to sort of keep ambulances available for more serious ones. You know, you asked about these near drownings at the Fort Lincoln,
yeah,
on Theodore Hagen's Drive or wherever that is. They flew them in the U.S. Park Police helicopter to MedStar Washington Hospital Center.
Yeah.
So that's not a lot of road miles, but it was probably faster to fly them in a helicopter than put them in an ambulance on the road during rush hour, and especially the units that showed up there.
Yeah.
That's one of the areas of town. I know you said besides more resources, but that's a part of town where, I think there's a lot of room for them to build another firehouse because there's not a lot of firehouses immediately close to there.
No.
But, yeah, so that's kind of essentially how it works. If you were to walk out of WHUR's office right now and walk over to the Howard University Hospital emergency room, you would see quite a lot of people sitting. You'd probably see several ambulances parked outside, and maybe one of those six ambulances was there for something serious like a heart attack. But a lot of the other ones, some more minor emergencies.
Yeah. Greg, I only have a few minutes left. You know, just from your perspective, what has gotten, have criminals gotten worse or, you know, what is the thing that's just really been making police officers' jobs more difficult? Are they bolder? And what do you think can make things better?
Well, what I would say is that there's a lot of aspects of the criminal justice system that are broken right now, right? The policing is broken because we just don't have the right number of police officers, and there's a lot of provisions that have been placed on us by the city council that make it difficult to do the job. But our members are still going out doing the job, typing the warrants and making the arrests. And the problem is when we bring those individuals into the court system, there's really no consequence. So even when these defendants are taken into court and they're convicted of crimes, serious crimes, violent crimes, heinous crimes, there really is no penalty there. And that goes for, particularly for juveniles, which are charged by the Office of the Attorney General here in the city. And the Office of the Attorney General has taken a position where they are just not going to hold juveniles accountable. And I'm not talking about, you know, stealing candy from the store. I'm talking about armed carjacking, shootings, and even murders in some cases, where these juveniles are being convicted of these crimes, but they're not serving any penalty at all for that. And that's one of the biggest problems, is that if there is no consequence for these actions, people have no fear or concern about committing or recommitting these crimes. And it happens in the adult world, too, with the U.S. Attorney's Office. They bring cases to the D.C. Superior Court. The individuals are convicted, and then the judges are just handing out probation and, you know, time served, and really what you would call revolving door justice. And when our officers are going out and they're getting these people locked up, they're putting them through the system, they're getting convicted, and there's no penalty. They're back out on the street the next day. Just absolutely frustrating for officers. It's frustrating for the community, and hopefully we can find a way out of it.
I want to thank both of you for your service, you know, on the streets, you know, saving lives and trying to protect the community. And certainly also thank you for helping to lead your rank and file and the service that they provide for the city. Dave Hoagland, Greg Pemberton, I appreciate your time in talking to us. We will be in touch.
Thank you so much.
That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, July 13th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.